This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. In just a couple of minutes, I'll be talking with pulmonologist Michael Stephen, who has treated COVID patients at Thomas Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia. He actually contracted the COVID virus last year, and he'll be joining us in just a couple of minutes to talk about his new book. It's called Breathtaking: The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. Well, Philadelphia public schools have been closed for almost a year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Superintendent William Height wants to open some of them on Monday, March 1st for thousands of younger students in pre-K through second grade for hybrid instruction. That was supposed to happen earlier this month, but the union balked at returning to in-classroom instruction because of concerns about safety, especially ventilation and vaccination. The district has reportedly spent millions working to get the schools ready for returning teachers, students, and personnel. There have been ongoing negotiations between the parties. Last week, we spoke with a kindergarten teacher and two parents, and today our guest is Dr. Height. He's been on the job in Philadelphia for 8 years. And Dr. Height, that was a close one, but thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure to be here, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. Can we all agree that most children in Philadelphia need to be in the classroom, that the union agrees, the parents agree, you agree, all the people sitting around the table? Is that the goal?
That is the goal, and that's what makes this so difficult. We all agree that there's not a sufficient replacement for in-person instruction, and that some of our young people are struggling in this virtual environment.
You want to open some schools for about 9,000 students in the lower grades, pre-K through 12. You want this to happen on Monday. Today is Thursday. Is that going to happen? Is that doable?
We're still working towards that date, Marty, and I'm remaining optimistic that we can do that. And hopefully, if not all schools that serve those populations, at least a portion of those schools that serve the populations. But as you know, today is Thursday. It's
yep.
getting close. We have to inform parents so that they can make sufficient plans. So we will be making an announcement later today, but we are still working. All the parties are working together, trying to resolve all of the issues that are still outstanding and taking a more nuanced approach instead of just like all buildings are safe or all buildings are unsafe, determining those buildings on which we all agree that can take adults and children right now and get those schools open while we continue through the mediation process with all of the others.
How many schools would you say, and the union would agree, are safe to open? How many schools are we talking about?
Yeah, that's the subject of the mediation. And so there's a number between 1 and 152.
that's a broad spread there you've got.
Indeed it is. And so we want to get as many of those facilities open as possible, as quickly as possible. But that's the subject of the mediation. What buildings can we all agree that can take individuals tomorrow, and or could have taken them before? And then how do we work on a plan to get all of the others in? And so don't want to throw any numbers out there, but that's right. The subject of the problems that we're trying to solve right now.
And does it boil down to issues of ventilation? I talked to a teacher and some parents and a public health person actually last week, and ventilation was a big part of our conversation. How important is that?
I think ventilation is important as one of the layers of safety that's in place. I think equally important are the social distancing guidelines, the masking, the hand sanitizing stations, the touchless water fountains, the fact that we've gone in and done some abatement with lead. We have been able to get into buildings to remove more asbestos. And I think all of those things together, the installation of plexiglass in offices and common spaces and and coming up with hybrid schedules. I think all of those are layered approaches, Marty, that according to the CDC, if in fact are in place, you reduce the risk of spreading the virus. And that's what we're trying to solve. I mean, and it is, while ventilation is what everyone is talking about now,
right?
I mean, it's been, in the past, it's been case counts, it's been vaccines, it's been the new strand. And I do think that, you know, with all of the safety precautions that are in place that meet the Centers for Disease Control's recommendations now, buildings are safe for the children whose families have indicated a desire for them to return.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. I saw, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners saw, some photos of what looked like small window fans in some of the classrooms. And some of the response was, well, that is just not inadequate. It didn't look like something as small and, frankly, kind of looked like it had been around the block a bit, that was going to provide the ventilation. What should we know about that?
Yeah, so the pictures were emerging on the fans, and then that became a subject of, like, a lot of conversations in social media and all of those things. But the fans are designed to introduce fresh air into classrooms, and the CDC actually indicates that schools or classrooms should open windows to introduce fresh air when they can. Or use fans in buildings, which is what we did. And those fans were installed in 32 facilities where, because of either work that had to be done on HVAC systems or house systems, that work has not been done or those systems are in disrepair. Since that period of time, we've repaired those systems in another 8 to 10 schools. So now that number has come down to about 22, 23 schools where we need to use the fans. And those fans are meant as a temporary solution to introduce fresh air. And I would say it went above and beyond the recommendations, and the recommendations were just to simply open a window.
Help us understand about that, and I'll put it this way because that's what people are saying, the kind of legacy of mistrust between the district and some of the teachers, things like deferred maintenance, asbestos. You had mentioned that, problems with buildings painted with oil paint. We know that the district is cash-strapped. We understand that. But at the same time, concerns that even if the district says we're doing this, can everyone in those buildings believe that it's really going to happen and happen correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the right question. And we understand why individuals would have those thoughts and feelings. And you and I have talked about this before, Marty.
We have.
What we've talked about is the problem with age-old buildings who haven't been sufficiently maintained. Because of a resource challenge, not just here recently, but decades of underfunding with facilities. And based on that, they haven't received the deferred maintenance that's necessary. And when you couple that with the fact that the average age of the buildings here in the School District of Philadelphia is 70 years old. And so there are lots of things that are happening in these facilities that when you haven't had the deferred maintenance over a period of time, then all of these things then come to a realization all at once. And so you have boiler systems, roof systems, you have infrastructures, you have lead paint in many of the buildings that were built before 1978, which is the vast majority of our buildings.
Right.
You have asbestos-containing materials. You have lead in the water. You have all of those things. And then you can't, you, as much as we would like to solve all of those things at once, it just simply can't be done because of same challenges, the resource challenges, and in this case, the capacity and time challenge. But I would also add that we know that there are other entities who also have old buildings. Some of those old buildings are old school buildings, and those individuals have also been open, and they've utilized the same protocols that we're talking about utilizing And you haven't seen the case counts increase from those facilities either. And I would add, the one final point I would add with this is, like, one of the reasons we want individuals back into buildings is to point these things out and to make sure that, like, we have all hands on deck. And if there's something that is in question, the more eyes we get on that, the faster we can get that problem resolved. And it's hard when it's just one person in every building with multiple classrooms trying to look at everything that's happening. It's a much easier solution when you have individuals who said, look, that thing right there doesn't look right, and need someone to take a look at it so that if it's a problem, we can get it addressed.
A couple more questions and just a couple of more minutes, Dr. Height. Can the district force teachers back into the classroom? And I know that there's a Peter Orris in Chicago. He's a mediator. He's been working on this. Who has the final say?
Well, ultimately, if in fact we decide that there's a day that individuals should be back in classrooms, we would expect those individuals to be back in classrooms. I can't force a person into a class, but there are procedures we could take. Individuals are compensated in order to teach. I would just add, Monty, that this is not in any way underappreciating the good work that teachers have been doing in classrooms since this pandemic started. They've been doing extraordinary work. But the fact of the matter is that we have families who want children in schools, and we said that we were going to base these decisions on choice and safety. Now the only ones having the choices are those who have indicated they don't want their children to return. Those families who want their kids back in schools, they still don't have the choice because we can't get individuals back into classrooms. And so it is an obligation of individuals' employment to be in the workplace that they're being employed to work within. And I think that, you know, that we're trying to work through the mediation process and continuing to work through the mediation process. But we may have to default at the end of the day to just requiring the individuals back, and then we would have to take the necessary steps if individuals choose not to come back.
And I hate to ask you this when we have almost no time. Is summer school an option, though, do you think, knowing that the children need some catch-up?
Oh, summer school is already an option. And not just summer school, but we will likely need to add a grading period. And we're going to have to utilize that time to also make up for lost learning that has been a product of the dealing with this pandemic. And so summer school is most definitely an option that's already on the table. And we are trying to determine how many facilities we'll be able to use that will have the right conditions during the summer months for children to learn and teachers to teach.
And Dr. Height, I'm sure we'll be talking to you as this issue evolves. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Indeed, Marty. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Our lungs are a marvel of form and function. When we breathe, we inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide 15 times a minute, 20,000 times a day. Our lungs are made up of miles of passages and millions of air sacs, all designed to keep us alive. From that first breath we draw as a baby to our last dying breath. While we breathe without thinking, COVID-19, the pandemic, has forced our attention on our respiration. We wear masks and physically distance to protect ourselves and others from spreading and contracting this respiratory virus. Our guest, Michael Stephen, is a pulmonologist at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia and has treated COVID patients. Last spring, he contracted the virus and got very, very sick. He's written a new book. It's called Breathtaking: The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about our lungs, how to take care of them, the threats that they face. And Michael Stephen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty, and it's a pleasure to talk about lung health with you.
Absolutely. We have a lot to talk about. Let's go back, I guess, about a year from now. You were working in the ICU at Jeff. Do you remember seeing patients struggling with their breath and wondering what it is that we are dealing with?
It was something really extraordinary and something that I've never seen in medicine in 25 years. And we just had no sense of what the natural history of this disease was. We had no good medicines, and we didn't have a great idea of how it spread. So there was a lot of fear in the hospital. And, you know, the medical community kind of panicked a little bit, sort of went from primum non nocere, first do no harm, to primum succere, rush to help. So there was tremendous anxiety, and for the first time, there was great personal risk.
Well, you are a pulmonologist, so your specialty is essentially breathing. And as you describe in your book, seeing people struggling with COVID, it looked like they were drowning, which, of course, seems like such a horrifying thing to try to deal with.
Yes, it took my breath away as well. You would see these patients come into the hospital. They would be talking to you, talking about their families, asking for a cup of tea, and then 10 hours later, they would be on a ventilator. So seeing that somebody fall off a cliff like that from a respiratory illness so quickly was something very new to me and something very scary.
You know, it reminded me of interviewing people about the early days of HIV when doctors and medical staff, they did not know what they were dealing with either. I mean, it's obviously a very different disease, but nonetheless, the same kind of conundrum for the medical community.
There was nobody to turn to. So usually in medicine, you know, you turn to your elders and for knowledge and wisdom, but there was nobody to turn to. We had no idea about the natural history of this disease, about what side effects. You know, we know now that it gets into the vessels, causes blood clots, can cause strokes, kidney failure, can get into the heart. Mm-hmm. So we know a lot more now, but at the start we knew nothing, and it was a scary time, no question.
You also describe a man who was very sick with what looked like COVID, and then he got really well really quickly, which just tells you how mysterious in many ways this virus can be.
Yeah, and it extends even more to that, right? So we know that a third of patients don't even know that they have it. And then, you know, there's this small minority who are in the hospital very, very sick, and a minority of those die. So that's very unusual to have this huge wide range of manifestations. Usually, if you get a virus, there's a typical course. Most people have a certain level of illness, but there's a wide range of levels of illness. You can get very sick and then get very better with no medicines. And then certainly, we know there are certainly a lot of people suffering with this.
Well, you got very sick. You were very sick with COVID.
I did. And I generally consider myself healthy, and I don't take any medicines. So for me to get very sick is kind of, you know, it was good for me to see life on the other end of the stethoscope, mm-hmm. and it sort of magnified the importance of the human touch and people listening to your story. So it was good for me in that respect. But I certainly did get sick, and a lot sicker than I would have predicted in myself, including blood clots in my lungs.
Yeah, you got blood clots, which put you in the hospital. High fevers, you talk about sort of having these strange and vivid dreams, and you literally felt like you were, and I'm quoting here from your book, fighting for your life.
Yeah, I don't know what that really means when you're just kind of trying to get through it, because our bodies are a mystery to us largely. Medicine is largely a mystery. So I understood there was a lot going on in my body. I didn't know where it was going to go. I was very hopeful, and I was one of the ones who got the best care in the world. Yeah. I was admitted to Jefferson Hospital, and everybody there was amazing.
And you describe what it felt to start healing, which I guess if you're not really, really sick, that sense of getting better is not everyone gets to experiencing that.
Yeah, there's this strange sort of give and take that you have with your body. With COVID, you can't fight your way out of it. And a lot of us, you know, we like to sort of exercise our way out of illness or do something with nutrition. And so for me to experience a few months of convalescence mm-hmm. was an understanding about the natural history of convalescence and the process of healing. You have to be patient with yourself, with your body. You have to listen to your body. This was a new experience for me. I'm usually, you know, going pretty quickly from day to day and from idea to idea and project to project. So it was a moment for me to slow down and listen to myself and my body.
How do you feel today? Do you feel like your old self?
I feel 100%. I consider myself really one of the lucky ones, and I was not a super spreader. I was a mini spreader, so I gave it to my wife and two young children. And, you know, seeing your nine-year-old daughter with a fever of 104 and not able to walk is not a fun thing. But we are lucky. We all recovered to 100%. It took me, you know, longer in retrospect. You know, I think it took me 4, 5, 6 months to get my strength back. But it did come back, and I'm very fortunate.
You describe it. I do want to talk about your book and about lungs, but just it's a chance to hear someone who's both a doctor but also had COVID. You describe the fatigue, but also the kind of brain fog that seems to come with COVID. Help us understand that.
It started almost right away for me, this sort of very intense brain fog. You know, my thoughts, I just could not keep them together. You know, what the fever, I didn't know if it was the fever or what, but once that cleared, this brain fog, this ability to concentrate, I found my thoughts wandering, and I didn't even realize my thoughts were wandering. So I couldn't even pull them back. That took, you know, a few months to get back to normal. But again, I feel like my old self now, but it's a very common symptom that I've been hearing. This very strange brain fog, this kind of removal from reality, which was unpleasant, but something that healed day to day.
But as you say, and as you write, it made you a better doctor.
I think so. And I use my story to motivate patients too, you know. You know, people get frustrated in the hospital. They're not making as much progress with their oxygen or with physical therapy. And I tell them, listen, you know, this took me several months to get better. And they say, you know, doc, that's really what I needed to hear to get going with physical therapy. Kind of getting back, you just can't bull your way out of this disease. You have to give your body time to heal with proper sleep and proper nutrition and pull back on other activities. You know, I didn't do much research for the number of months that I was ill.
Are you a more humble doctor?
Most definitely. You know, I'm less rushed. So when I go into a room, I know that, you know, you have to give that patient 2 minutes to talk. You know, in one study, it was shown that doctors interrupt in the first 11 seconds, you know, 90% of the time. You know, they've taped doctors, and that happens. And patients want to be heard, and that's how you do the best medicine. When you listen to your patient and you listen to their symptoms and you get to know them, you know, medical diagnosis is all in the history, in asking them about their symptoms, when things started. And so I think it certainly has made me a better doctor.
We hear about medical people, frankly, not wanting to touch or feeling if they touch a patient, it could be harmful to the patient or to them. What happens to touch under COVID?
Yeah. Well, it went away. You know, the physical exam went away. And we were told, you know, to conserve PPE, don't go in the rooms, phone call sometimes. And then certainly when you're in the room, you don't want to certainly touch people and spread it from person to person. And so it's been a balance, and it's been a balance in terms of, you know, transmitting the virus and then people's own fear as well. But touching, the human touch is so important. You know, when you take people's blood pressure, it's been shown that when you do it manually because of touch and you've got your hands on their shoulder and your hands on their arm, blood pressures are lower versus whether you just hook them up to a machine to do this. So the human touch is very, very important, and we need to get back to it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you think we will?
Most definitely. We've started doing physical exams now. Almost all, you know, healthcare personnel are vaccinated at this point. We feel much more comfortable with this disease and how we think it spreads. So we've learned a tremendous amount, and so many people have done such amazing work. And you know, I got very sick, and it was a very stressful situation, but being part of the medical community during this time, you know, I felt like I was watching, you know, the men and women of D-Day, here, keeping society together as things could fall apart. And so it was truly an honor.
Well, we owe so much to people on the front line of this disease. Let me reintroduce you and let's talk about your book. Let's talk about lungs. And again, Michael Stephen is our guest. He's a pulmonologist at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. Was telling us about what happened to him when he contracted COVID-19, and he does work with COVID patients. He's got a new book. It's called Breathtaking, The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs, and he is the director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center at Jeff. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Michael, you really say that, you know, when it comes to our organs, that the lung doesn't get as much respect as it deserves. Why is that, do you think?
It's been ignored. And, you know, between 1960 and 1998, you know, lung diseases increased by a whopping 163% in terms of mortality, whereas all-cause mortality dropped by 7%, you know, including cardiovascular disease and oncology disease. But to answer your question, I think there's several reasons. You know, the lungs have been known to contract viruses, and tuberculosis has killed more than any other infectious disease in the history of humanity. So there's been this understanding historically going back hundreds of years that the lungs can be a little bit of a dirty place, right? And people don't like to talk about mucus. And when there's a cough or a sneeze, people suppress it or they move away from that person. So these sort of scare genes, I think, about coughing and sneezing have been implanted in us. And, you know, people don't like to talk about mucus or analyze mucus. The other thing I will say is that there's, you know, tremendous give in the lungs, too. So we can damage our lungs to a certain extent. We could even take out one lung in most people and they would be perfectly fine. So we can ignore them. And most of the times they will do quite well. Unfortunately, you know, with COVID, with wildfires, with our atmosphere and global warming, we're seeing a tipping point where we're really falling off a cliff in terms of our lung health, and we need to change directions very quickly.
And I do want to get to that, but just since I have you on the radio and you are a pulmonologist, and I was reading about the lungs, 1,500 miles of passages in our lungs, correct?
That's correct. Yep. So here to Chicago and back, and it's all condensed in this very small space.
Wow.
And then 500 million, you know, gas exchange units or alveoli, you know, spread them out over an entire tennis court. So we pack a lot of power into that area of our chest.
And it's both fragile and it's strong. And as you write, it's also something we do without thinking, but we can also do with thinking. We can be very conscious. I mean, I can take a big breath because I'm thinking about it, which is unusual for an organ, I guess.
Yeah, we don't have much control over our heart rate. I don't think many people have control over their thoughts that go through their head.
You know? It sort of feels that way, yes.
Right? But I think the one area of control that we do have that can bring us back and center us is our breathing. And, you know, there's deep stimulation of the parasympathetic nervous system that goes on when we take deep breaths with our diaphragm. And we see this in children who breathe so naturally with their belly.
Right.
And then as we get older, I think, you know, stress moves to our shoulders and we get away from good belly breathing and to our detriment. So yeah, appropriate breathing is very important. And, you know, the Buddha had it right 2,500 years ago when he said, the only path to nirvana and wisdom is through a dedicated focus on the breath.
And the belly, just as you said, belly breathing, I said, oh yeah, right, belly breathing. And then I breathe from my belly, not from my chest. Is it just because we're so stressed that we just don't know how to breathe as we get older?
I think so. I think that's a big part of it. I think what, you know, some of the stimulants, you know, drugs and alcohol do unnaturally is kind of help us slow our breathing, which can be beneficial. But of course, we want to do it naturally through appropriate breathing exercises. And we just don't talk about it in this country. You know, they talk about prana, they talk about chi, they have a deeper respect for the atmosphere in the Far East. They'll put a mask on if they have a virus or it's a high pollution day. In Europe, they talk about singing a lot. They do a lot of singing, and they say, you know, when you sing, you have to sing from your diaphragm. So we need to start talking about these things more in this country, the importance of using the diaphragm, the importance of strengthening the muscles of the chest and keeping a healthy weight. It all goes together.
It all goes, and certainly with acting, having taken acting classes, in many ways, it all boiled down to breathing. It was incredible.
Yeah, and it's taught in theater, it's taught in singing, but we don't focus on it enough in the schools. It needs to be in our schools, it needs to be in our culture.
A comment from Paul, how is it that some people can smoke for years and not destroy their lungs?
That's a great question, and goes back to genetics. You know, we don't understand, our lungs are still very much a mystery. We have some things figured out, so he's absolutely right. You know, 85% of people who can smoke, you know, a pack a day for many years will have no problems, and that's because there's tremendous reserve in our lungs. You know, we can go down to 30-40% lung function, and we may not even notice it. But as I said, a significant portion of these people, you know, there's still 34 million smokers in this country, will develop significant lung damage that will severely limit their breathing and their lifespan.
We're almost up on a break here. I remember going to an exhibit. It was all about body parts. That sounds kind of macabre. But there was a picture, or I guess an actual frozen or ossified lung that had cancer, lung cancer, and it was just black.
It's scary. It is scary when you look at the gross pathology of the lungs when they are damaged, because there is so much damage that happens before you notice it. And I think bringing these pictures out can help people. You know, in Australia, they put these pictures on the packs of cigarette smokes. And we're not allowed to do that in this country, but you're absolutely right. We can't see it. I think if we saw it and had a visual of it, the starkness of lung disease would be driven home.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Stephen. He's a pulmonologist at Thomas Jefferson University. We're talking about the lungs. He's got a new book. It's called Breathtaking, and it's subtitled The Power, the Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us, questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. With the COVID-19 pandemic, we are all paying, or should be paying attention, more attention on our breath, our lungs. Our guest is pulmonologist Michael Stephen, has treated COVID patients at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. In fact, contracted the virus last year, and he joins us to talk about his new book, Breathtaking, The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. Let me pick up on something. You talk about the threats, I guess, to our lungs, whether indoor or outdoor pollution. But you write that respiratory infections from air pollution and secondhand smoke is the leading killer of children under the age of 5 worldwide. Something like 500,000 children die as a result of this kind of pollution. Help us understand what's going on with children.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And children, you know, their lungs are developing, their cells are dividing and growing. And at that point in their lives, the cells are just more susceptible to the effects of pollution. So these particles, whether it's carbon monoxide or ozone or sulfur dioxide or tobacco or particulate matter, more easily get into the cells of their lungs and causing damage. And the big issue then becomes infections. Viruses and bacteria can then find a foothold in their lungs. And so this is what's happening worldwide. Not so much in this country. It happens with women, too. You know, they are also more susceptible to the toxic effects of of pollution and nicotine, and they develop COPD at higher rates and lower smoking levels than men.
Why is that?
Again, I think it has to do with the size of their lungs. They're generally smaller, but they're inhaling the same levels of pollution, so the percentage is higher in comparison. And then there may be a lot of things that we don't understand is going on with genetics. But on the flip side, we do know a lot about our atmosphere and how we need to make it better.
Asthma, I didn't realize the root definition of asthma is noisy breathing, which, you know, makes sense. Apparently that goes back thousands of years. But certainly we know in cities like Philadelphia, which have, you know, old houses, the problem of childhood asthma is a serious one. Help us understand what asthma means for children and what can be done to help them.
Asthma is been a huge expanding problem in this country and worldwide. You know, 3% of the total population had asthma in 1980, and now, you know, it's over 8%, you know, over 12% in children. It's the number one reason, you know, children go to the emergency room, and it's the number one chronic illness in children.
And that's in the United States or worldwide?
That's in the United States. Wow. You know, 1 out of 12 children have asthma in this country. So it's a scary statistic. And again, goes back to their lungs are growing, and so they're very susceptible to toxic effects, to effects of allergies. And we're having a lot more pollen in this country and throughout the world. You know, there's 20% more vegetation now because of rising carbon dioxide levels, and because of that, plants are cranking out a lot more pollen, and it's also not freezing as much over the winter. So there's been sort of a radically changing environment, and it's been hitting our kids the hardest because, you know, of the susceptibility of their growing lungs.
Well, and you write about it, it's called global greening, and to be honest with you, I had never thought about that. So there's actually more vegetation creating, as you describe, more pollen as a result of pollution?
As a result of carbon dioxide.
Of carbon dioxide.
So if you look at, you know, rising CO2 levels, you know, plants do photosynthesis. They take CO2 and they convert it to oxygen. And then, you know, we sort of do the opposite with our metabolism. But with that extra CO2 now in the atmosphere, the plants really like that. And there is, in fact, you know, they can tell by satellite images, there's a lot more vegetation these days. It's going to level off at some point, and it's not really going to help us out of the global warming crisis. Yeah. But for now, we are stuck with this incredible increasing amount of pollen. And certainly, you know, here in Philadelphia, you know, we live basically kind of in a swamp. And so pollen is a big issue.
I'm curious, though, about children living in neighborhoods or in houses, I guess, where they are susceptible to asthma. Is it that it's just old infrastructure, or it's lead paint, or it's, you know, dust bunnies?
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, it could be a ventilation issue. I think, you know, pollution levels within the city can be quite high. Philadelphia, mm-hmm. you know, generally does not rank very well in terms of a healthy atmosphere. It's any exposure to secondhand smoke can be an issue. And, you know, sometimes pollution, you know, just sits over these cities because of sort of overall ventilation and air movement. And so there's a lot of factors, but it is a huge problem right now.
I mean, can children, I'm looking at the subtitle of your book, you know, The Power, Fragility of Extraordinary Lungs. So on the one hand, there's the fragility, but can someone with childhood asthma, can they outgrow it? Can they beat it? Can they fix their lungs?
So it's very common to outgrow asthma. What we're seeing these days, because of elevated pollen and pollution levels, that it's coming back more in a lot of people. So a lot of these questions, you know, we sort of had answers to maybe 30 years ago, but it's all changing now, and we have no idea. So what percentage of these kids who have asthma today is it going to go away in? The answer used to be a lot. It may not be the same answer anymore. And you know, when you're older, it generally comes back in a milder form. Well, that may not be the case anymore. I'm seeing a lot more patients come back to me with diagnoses of new asthma in their 40s, in their 50s, which was unheard of a generation ago.
Wow. A couple of comments. One from Melissa. She says the World Health Organization prioritizes asthma sufferers for the COVID vaccine. The CDC does not, and she wants to know why. Do you have an answer to that, Michael Stephen?
Well, I think probably, you know, the CDC is just looking at sort of data within our country, and the WHO is probably maybe looking at other data. And so there may be more damage to the asthma patients worldwide than specifically in the United States. So I think the WHO is just looking at our data and overall data of asthmatics in terms of mortality and COVID outcomes, and then making that designation based on that.
So, Tom, did you want to add something?
It could be kind of just two quite different diseases here in the U.S. and worldwide.
Thomas asks, please ask your guest to comment on vaping's effect on the lungs. Have you looked at that?
Yes, and I talk about it in my book. It's another one of these crises, you know, the wildfires, the vaping, COVID. These are all just the tip of the iceberg of what's going on with our atmosphere and our breathing that we need to change course. There was a huge crisis in vaping in 2019, mostly in young kids who don't see this as a problem. It is a problem. It's toxic to the lungs. It can induce this very, very scary lung failure where you end up on ventilators. Dozens of kids have died from this vaping crisis. So I would stay away from vaping.
And that is Michael Stephen, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a pulmonologist, and he's also written a book called Breathtaking: The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us a question or comment at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Help us understand what cystic fibrosis is, what that does to the lungs.
Yeah, so a big part of my career has been dealing with cystic fibrosis patients and understanding this disease. I walked into my first clinic at the University of Pennsylvania and fell in love, and I fell in love with it because tremendous courage in these patients. It's a genetic illness. It causes intense inflammation and infections in the lung, you know, from a very young age. So they have to work very hard on getting the mucus out of their chest, on staying hydrated. A lot of them go into the hospital once or twice a year for intravenous antibiotics. So I saw a lot of courage in these patients and a tremendous amount of work that they put into this disease. And it was just an amazing community that you know, I started back in 2006. And it's been a great career.
And people with cystic fibrosis can live into their 50s, right? I mean, there's been a lot of progress on that front.
Extraordinary progress. Dorothy Anderson, I talk about this in my book, you know, basically described the disease for the first time in 1938. She was a pathologist at Columbia. You know, she got denied a surgical residency because of her gender, but she did well. And she described the disease. They would only live a few months back then. And now, you know, the life expectancy is you know, scratching at 50 years. So there's been tremendous progress, new medicines, just an amazing spirit of investigation from, you know, starts at the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, which has roots in Philadelphia, in the researchers and the clinicians and the patients and the families. It was just this huge community that joined together and said, you know, in 50 years, we want to cure this disease. And they're getting very close.
Wow. Wow. Here's a question from Wanda. I had COVID and breathing problems and the brain fog. I'm feeling better, but I notice that sometimes the symptoms come back suddenly. I'm wondering with warmer weather or other illnesses if I will have issues again. Can you answer that?
I can't, and we don't know. But I have heard those symptoms described, which Wanda says. And, you know, we need to take everything that she says very seriously and investigate every issue like she says very seriously. And I've had patients tell me, I've been fine, and then suddenly I'm short of breath. So is this an issue with the heart? You know, is this an issue with the blood vessels in her lung that we don't really know, we can't pick up with our studies? Is it an issue with asthma exacerbating her? So we're collecting information. There's going to be just a massive collection of information and see what happens in terms of, because it's such a weird disease and does many weird things, but we have to take complaints like that very seriously and do a very thorough workup on these people and then, you know, aggregate our data and see where we stand with it.
And our vaccinations, I mean, they're coming, we're told. How much do you think this will mitigate the problems of COVID?
I think we have a tremendous chance here, Marty, to really crush this thing. So we know, you know, standing 6 feet apart, not congregating indoors, you know, if you feel ill, get a test and self-isolate. And you can do a lot with just public health measures. And, you know, we've come a long way. You know, they say this great decline that we're seeing now is not really the vaccine. It's the public health measures that we've put in place. Mm-hmm. And you get the public health you pay for. The vaccine, I think, can be tremendously helpful. To have a vaccine that's 95% effective and totally preventing the disease with zero hospitalizations and no deaths is extraordinary. So we got to act now before mutations get out there too much, but we have a huge opportunity here.
And the more cases, the more chance for mutations, correct?
That's correct. And I think a lot of the mutations are hanging out in sort of immunosuppressed patients because the virus can stay in there longer and work its mischief longer. So getting immunosuppressed patients the vaccine is very, very important to decrease these mutations. But eventually, you know, we just need to all get vaccinated as much as possible.
Here's a question from Paul. How do the chemicals in new homes, new furniture, rugs, et cetera, paint impact our breathing and our health?
So I think, you know, indoor air quality is very important. It's something, you know, we don't talk about, and we don't have a lot of answers to these diseases. Checking your house for radon is important. The effects of, you know, you need a certain level of ventilation as well. And, you know, when you're cooking, you should have a fan on. If there's obvious toxic things going on in your house, you know, you shouldn't be burning stuff at all. You know, try and stay away from wood stoves or burning any garbage. In terms of paint and things like this, you know, I think using common sense and, you know, if you smell something, you know, ventilate the area, stay away from it, you know, wear a mask when you need to. It's not something we talk about in this country enough.
Does marijuana have any impact on the lungs?
It most certainly does. And, you know, people ask about marijuana and vaping and all this stuff. And, you know, my basic approach is you should not be inhaling anything into your lungs other than clean air and perhaps some medicines if you have a condition that warrants it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, marijuana can have very deleterious effects on the lungs, especially if used over a chronic long period of time. So it doesn't seem to be as toxic as cigarettes, does not seem to induce lung cancer, but you can get inflammation from marijuana, and breathing clean air is what we're meant to do. I would stay away from all this other stuff.
Let me squeeze one more comment, and this from Thomas. When I was a teenager, I noticed my asthma would flare up when I was depressed or blue. There was an emotional connection. Is this something that researchers are looking at? Have you found that?
No question. But I think there's a biological basis to it. You know, as we get stressed, our serotonin levels go down, and that allows our body to get more inflamed. So it's not just in the head. And so treating depression, you know, with, I think, good breathing exercises, but depression can certainly feed into asthma and lung diseases. And I think, I'm quite sure there's a biological basis to it. And doing lung exercises that improve your mood and strength can certainly go a long way to helping you with asthma.
We're almost out of time here, but we read about some opera singers in England who've been working with COVID patients to help them learn to breathe again, I guess, breathe like an opera singer. As a pulmonologist, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And what's absolutely fascinating about COVID and these opera singers getting involved is when we inhale, most of the particles go to the lower part of our lungs. COVID is a lower lobe inflammation. So working with opera singers who understand expanding the diaphragm, getting airflow then down there, getting the toxins out of our system in the lower parts of our lungs, I think is absolutely the right thing to do. And it's going to treat your mood, too. You're going to release serotonin as you do that belly breathing.
Well, Michael Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. I learned a lot about our lungs.
It's been a pleasure, Marty. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And again, he's Associate Professor at Thomas Jefferson University, Director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center. And he's the author of a new book, Breathtaking, The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for joining us.